Hi, airspace fans. Season 7 is over, but don't despair. We have a very exciting episode from our friends at the Smithsonian's other podcast, Side Door. And to explain it, we brought in Side Door's host, Lizzie Peabody, to tell us about it.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
It's so good to talk to you, Lizzie, today. I was just listening to this episode, even though it isn't a brand new episode. And I'm always so pleasantly surprised when I'm listening through Side Door and all of a sudden there's an air or space adjacent episode.
Yeah. So this is an air episode as opposed to a space episode. And it's actually about a feud between the Wright brothers and the Smithsonian, which I think a lot of people don't know about. And the main bargaining chip in this feud was one of the most central objects in the collection of the National Air and Space Museum, the 1903 Wright Flyer, the first heavier-than-air powered piloted aircraft to fly, which we almost did not get. Like, we were very, very close to never having this at the museum. And I especially love this story because we are the villain. Like, unequivocally, the Smithsonian is the bad guy in this story. And that makes me love this story even more.
Well, everybody loves a villain origin story.
No, Matt, we've corrected it. We've mended our ways now.
Man. Okay. I was looking forward to thinking of myself as a henchman, you know?
You can still think of yourself as a henchman, just in other areas of your life. You have to find some other villain to help.
Okay.
Today on Airspace, Wronging the Wrights, from the Smithsonian's other podcast, Side Door.
This is Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Lizzie Peabody. All right, should we go in?
Sure.
When you're standing in front of a single object that changed the world, it's hard not to feel small.
Wow, it's a lot bigger in person than you realize.
Well, that happens with a lot of our collection. When you bring airplanes inside of a building, they get bigger.
Stretching across this gallery of the Smithsonian's newly renovated National Air and Space Museum is a machine made of white muslin, spindly wood, and wire. It's the airplane that carried Wilbur Wright over 800 feet through the air along a blustery beach in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina.
The 1903 Wright Flyer is a seminal object, not only because it's the first airplane to make a successful flight, which it did, but what makes it even more important is that it embodies all the basic principles of every airplane that flew subsequently. Every airplane that flies today is really a Wright Flyer in terms of how it's fundamentally designed and constructed.
Peter Jacob, senior curator at the National Air and Space Museum, says even today's fastest, highest-flying jet is just a souped-up Wright Flyer. So it means a lot to have the original right here at the museum.
The Wright Flyer is one of the signature objects of the Smithsonian. It's one of the things that's most powerfully associated with the institution, and it certainly is a centerpiece here at the National Air and Space Museum.
But that wasn't always the case. Before it arrived at the Smithsonian, this airplane was a bargaining chip in a bitter, decades-long feud that pitted bicycle builders from Ohio against a powerful and proud adversary, the Smithsonian itself. The story of that feud and how the Wright Flyer landed right here after the break. If you happen to take a stroll along the banks of the Potomac River just outside Washington, D.C. on December 8th, 1903, you'd have been pretty chilly.
It was a really cold day. In fact, there was ice on the Potomac.
The National Air and Space Museum's senior curator emeritus, Tom Crouch, says if on that December day you'd wandered up around Buzzard's Point, you'd have stumbled upon a small crowd.
The official Smithsonian photographer was there and all that. Reporters in boats, as well as people watching from the bank of the river.
And if you'd craned your neck to peer above the heads of the crowd, you'd have seen a peculiar sight. In the middle of the river, a houseboat was anchored. And on the roof of that houseboat sat what looked like a giant dragonfly, a machine with 50-foot sail-like wings and twin propellers, poised on top of a catapult.
They were going to shoot it into the air from the roof of a houseboat using streetcar springs to power the catapult.
The crowd was as tightly wound as the streetcar springs, because if all went well, they would be witnesses to a first in human history. The first time an airplane, powered by an engine, would be flown through the air by a pilot. A pilot now climbing into the plane.
Oh, it must have been incredibly tense and exciting.
The flying machine poised for launch that day was the invention of astrophysicist Samuel Pierpont Langley. At the time, Langley was the head of the Smithsonian, or secretary of the Smithsonian, a title that also made him the nation's unofficial chief scientist. And according to Peter Jacob, Langley did not mind being the chief.
He had a tendency to fire people roughly, and
wow,
then immediately say, where is so-and-so? He said, well, you just fired him. Well, no, get him back here, you know, that kind of a thing.
Langley would conduct every Friday white glove inspections.
What?
Literally.
What does that even mean?
He would do it in a morning coat and going from room to room, making sure everything was in order.
He knew who he was.
And he was important. Langley became secretary during a time of tremendous technological change. The 1880s to the 1910s saw the invention of the incandescent light bulb, early radio, automobiles, all sorts of things we take for granted as part of modern life today. Now, it's also during that time that the study of flight goes from a pie-in-the-sky fool's errand to a serious course of study. And Samuel Langley, as the nation's chief scientist, was captivated. He'd spent years doing experiments on model airplanes powered by engines, which he called aerodromes. In 1896, his most successful model flew nearly 3/4 of a mile.
And that was the first time that anybody had flown a heavier-than-air machine, powered heavier-than-air machine, for a significant distance.
The success earned Langley a federal grant to turn his unmanned model into a full-size plane, which he did. And that was the machine sitting on the Potomac River in December 1903, the Great Aerodrome. The plan was to launch Langley's plane into the air by catapult. Once aloft, its powerful 52-horsepower engine would carry it through the sky, directed by a pilot.
Charles Matthews Manley, Langley's aerodromic assistant, who was semi-volunteer as pilot.
Semi-volunteer?
Yeah.
This was not an easy gig, because the Great Aerodrome was designed from an unmanned model with no control system. So Manley wouldn't actually have a lot of control over the airplane.
He's more like a passenger than a pilot.
Passenger or pilot, he was preparing to get wet.
Unfortunately, the pilot sits kind of the lowest thing in the machine. So if the Great Aerodrome works as advertised, if they fly it a mile down the river and it comes gently to rest in the water, when everything's said and done, the pilot's going to be underwater.
And that's the best case scenario?
That's the best case scenario.
But who's thinking about landing when history's about to be made in the air? Manley climbed aboard the Great Aerodrome. The Smithsonian photographer readied his camera. The Great Aerodrome's engine whirred like a big insect, propellers spinning.
Now, this thing is going to go from zero to flying speed in less than 60 feet.
Manley gives the signal. The crowd inhales together. And they release the catapult.
Bang, like that.
The aerodrome hurtles forward into the air, up, up.
It actually goes nose up in the air and comes down sort of upside down.
It crashed, big time.
I mean, broken wood, snapped wires,
oh my
fabric.
God.
forget flying. It couldn't take the impact of launch.
Miraculously, Manley, the pilot, was okay. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for the reputation of Samuel Langley. Congress had just watched the modern-day equivalent of nearly $2 million government dollars plummet into the Potomac. In the words of one reporter, like a handful of mortar. The papers were all over it.
The aerodrome became the mud duck, an albatross.
The great aerodrome was dredged from the water, but its extraordinarily public failure sank Langley's scientific standing. All of his previous accomplishments suddenly seemed irrelevant. Peter Jacob says,
he should have quit while he was ahead, because Langley made the fundamental mistake of thinking he could simply scale up the aerodrome number 5 and build a full-size piloted flying machine.
Langley had taken his successful model airplane, the aerodrome number 5, and just made it bigger. In hindsight, his mistake was obvious.
You can't just simply scale things up directly. There's an exponential factor in the structural design of Langley's aerodrome when he tried to make the full-size one, simply was structurally unsound.
And Langley's failure gave the impression that human flight was still a far-off fantasy. I mean, if America's chief scientist couldn't figure it out, who could? A U.S. Army observer watching that day wrote,
"We are still far from the ultimate goal, and it would seem as if years of constant work and study by experts, together with the expenditure of thousands of dollars, would still be necessary before we can hope to produce an apparatus of practical utility on these lines."
But it wouldn't be years. It would be days. 9 days later, on a desolate stretch of beach 200 miles south of Washington, a couple of bicycle mechanics from Ohio tested their flying machine. Orville lay flat in the center of the plane. His brother Wilbur held the wing, like a father holding the handlebar of a tricycle, guiding it down a wooden track in the sand. A little 12-horsepower engine picked up speed. The wind blew sand that stung their skin. And then Wilbur let go of the wing. The flyer lifted into the air. A camera shutter clicked. And history was made.
It's extraordinary that we have the moment one of the great inventions happened.
The image of this exact moment hangs in the Wright Brothers Gallery of the National Air and Space Museum. The photo captures a success that was about as private as Langley's failure had been public. After all,
the Wrights were not guys with their hair on fire wanting to go out and bore holes in the sky. They were doing this because it was a problem that interested them.
The Wright brothers really were more engineers, not scientists. And there's a big distinction between that. Scientists are often generally trying to understand phenomenon in nature. They're trying to explain why things happen the way they do. Engineers are trying to build things. Engineers are trying to make things.
The 1903 Wright Flyer made 4 successful flights that day in Kitty Hawk. The last was the longest, 59 seconds in the air.
And they knew, in their heart of hearts, they knew they'd done it.
Wilbur and Orville Wright spent the next several years patenting and quietly perfecting the technology behind the flyer. Finally, in 1908, they showcased their invention in a series of international flight demonstrations that effectively bored holes in the sky.
They really became kind of the first modern celebrities. You know, the way we define celebrity today, where someone does something and they're instantly famous and everybody wants a piece of them and that sort of thing. The Wrights were sort of the first figures like that.
It's unclear what Samuel Pierpont Langley might have thought of the Wrights. He never lived to see them soar to international fame. He died only 3 years after the failure of his aerodrome, in 1906, at the age of 71.
And really, he kind of died a broken man, just kind of humiliated by the failure of the great aerodrome.
But while Langley himself was gone, the world had not seen the last of his infamous flying machine that did not fly. The not-so-great aerodrome returns after the break. After After Secretary Samuel Pierpont Langley died, a new secretary took office at the Smithsonian, Charles Doolittle Walcott. Walcott was a geologist, and according to Tom Crouch, a good one.
Walcott may have been the best scientist who's ever been secretary.
But even great scientists can suffer from questionable judgment. Walcott had been a close friend of Samuel Langley's, and after Langley died, Walcott wanted to restore his friend's tarnished reputation. So he used his new position as secretary to Langleyify as much as possible.
So he established the Langley Aeronautical Laboratory, put up a plaque in the castle honoring Langley, established the Langley Medal.
He even declared a holiday.
Langley Day.
When Smithsonian employees got the day off and distinguished aviators came to the Capitol to fly planes on the mall and wow people. As a Smithsonian employee, I have to say, I don't know what happened to this, but I am pretty sure we should bring it back. Secretary Bunch, if you're listening. So, one fine Langley Day in 1914, Charles Doolittle Walcott is enjoying the festivities in honor of his old friend, when a mustachioed man, probably wearing a boater hat, saunters up to him and says,
"Can I have the sad remains of the O3 aerodrome? I'm interested in tandem wing airplanes," he said, "and you'll save me a little time and money if I can rebuild that one instead of building it. Yeah, yeah, yeah."
Now, it may have occurred to Walcott that there are better ways to research tandem wing airplanes than to rebuild the broken remains of a decade-old machine that never flew. Nevertheless,
Walcott said, "Sure."
And in hindsight, it's easy to see this as Walcott's first mistake. Because the man who'd approached him was Glenn Curtis, who at that very moment was locked in a vicious patent dispute with Orville Wright. Can you kind of summarize the patent controversy between the Wright brothers and Glenn Curtis?
Well, that's probably an entire podcast on its own.
Fair enough, but not this podcast. So to sum it up, the patent that the Wrights got on their flying machine was really broad. So broad, it was pretty much impossible for anyone to make another flying machine without infringing on it. And the Wrights were pretty chill about people building planes as long as those people were experimenting for the fun of it. But as soon as someone started making money on their airplanes,
when they started demonstrating them publicly or entering them in competitions for prizes, those sorts of things, the Wrights started filing patent infringement suits and were expecting people to pay them a royalty for what they were doing.
Glenn Curtis was a star mechanic and motorcycle racer who'd started building planes with amazingly lightweight engines and selling them.
And he was really the principal person in the United States who was doing that.
And Curtis didn't want to have to pay the Wright brothers a cent. So the Wright brothers sued him, and the case dragged out in court for years. The legal slog was so bad that when Wilbur Wright died of typhoid fever in 1912, Orville blamed the stress of the patent suits for weakening him. And Orville was left alone to defend their invention.
By this time, the center of aeronautical development and manufacture had really shifted to Europe. And the Wrights had filed patent infringement suits in many European countries as well. But in the United States, Curtis was the big rival.
Curtis finally lost the patent case in January 1914, but he was not about to give up. So later that year, when he approached Walcott at Langley Day with his proposition to go fix up the great aerodrome,
what he's actually thinking is, if he can get this thing in the air, geez, he can go back to court and say, "See, somebody was capable of flight before the Wright brothers. They don't deserve that patent."
Oh, it's a Hail Mary to save his own patent suit.
It was.
Both men had something to gain. Curtis figured if he could prove that Langley's aerodrome was capable of flight in 1903, he could have the Wright brothers' patent invalidated. And for Walcott, what better way to redeem his old friend's reputation than to put his failed invention in the sky? So off Glenn Curtis goes with the aerodrome up to his shop in New York. He is determined to make it fly. And to do that, he needs to make a few minor adjustments.
The first thing Curtis has to do is figure out where to put the pilot, since They're not going to catapult him into the air, and he can't start the takeoff underwater. So they put the machine on floats.
Curtis moves the pilot from the bottom of the plane to the top of the plane, and he ditches the catapult. And he puts in a new engine, and a better control system, and new wings, and a new tail, moves some kingpins and trusses around, you know, minor adjustments. Now, by this time, Orville Wright is starting to get a little suspicious. When he finds out that Secretary Walcott is letting his arch nemesis rebuild and test fly the old Langley Aerodrome from 1903, he's pretty sure there's some shenanigans going on. So he decides to send his other brother, Lauren, to spy on the reconstructed aerodrome's flight test. He figures Lauren's not famous.
Nobody was going to recognize Lauren. So take a look, see what was going on.
Only
they did recognize Lauren. They took his camera away and
oh my gosh, really?
Turned him away. Yep.
This is like real espionage. Lo and behold, in May of 1914, the refurbished Langley Aerodrome flew. A few short flights along the surface of a lake in New York. Secretary Walcott wasn't there to see it, but he'd sent a delegate on his behalf, a fella named Al Zahm.
Zahm was a first-rate engineer. He was no slouch.
But Al Zahm had beef with the Wright brothers. In fact, he'd actually testified against them in court as a key witness for Glenn Curtis.
Here's Al Zahm, who really has a thing for the Wright brothers.
Not a good thing.
Not a good thing. He does a report that he brings back to Walcott in which he says, essentially, okay, we've done it. That machine is the world's first flying machine capable of flight. Okay, the Wrights flew first, but by golly, Langley was capable of doing it if only things had gone a little different.
What Al Zahm fails to mention in this report is all the changes Curtis made to the original aerodrome. I mean,
it was not the same airplane. Curtis had radically modified the airplane to make it fly.
But Walcott was all too glad to hear the news and spread it. He didn't ask any follow-up questions. He just ordered the aerodrome back to D.C. to be prepared for display.
The real mistake that the Smithsonian made at that point was to reconstruct the airplane yet again, returning it to its original 1903 configuration and identifying it as the world's first airplane capable of flight.
Did you get that? Langley's failed 1903 aerodrome, the one that sank like a block of mortar, was displayed at the Smithsonian with a label calling it the first man-carrying airplane in the history of the world capable of sustained free flight.
Well, this was a rather misleading position because the airplane couldn't have flown in its original configuration.
When Orville Wright found out about this, he was peeved. But he didn't say anything. He didn't want to look like he was picking on poor dead Samuel Langley. And besides, he wasn't even sure if Secretary Walcott knew about all the changes to the aerodrome. Maybe the Smithsonian had been duped by Glenn Curtis. Orville stayed quiet for years. Until, in 1921, an aviator friend of his published a complete catalog of all the changes to Langley's machine, using photographs published by the Smithsonian as evidence. The information was out there for all to see.
And at that point, Orville really had something he could point to. And what he begins saying is, I don't want to bash Samuel Langley. All I'm worried about is those 1914 tests. I think you ought to tell people the truth, that you made these changes, X, Y, and Z. Tell them what changes you made, and I'll be happy. And they wouldn't do it.
Who wouldn't do it?
The Smithsonian wouldn't.
Orville didn't back down. He wrote letters to Secretary Walcott, government officials. He even wrote to William Howard Taft, who was Chief Justice at the time.
And he couldn't get anybody to pay any attention to him at all. It was really maddening.
Why didn't Walcott pay attention at that point? Why did nothing change? I mean, clearly they had then documentation of...
He didn't want to.
He
He just didn't want to.
Mm-hmm. His commitment to Langley was so strong that what he was saying to himself was, I don't know how important those changes were. Maybe they weren't important at all. Mm-hmm. But the point is, he wouldn't budge.
Walcott walled himself inside his castle and told himself what he wanted to hear. And from that high perch, he had the power not only to delude himself, but to mislead anyone who looked to the Smithsonian as a source of scientific truth. Orville Wright was beginning to feel like David battling Goliath. So in 1925, he picked up the only weapon within his grasp, and he took good aim.
Orville comes up with the best idea he's had since the invention of the airplane. He said, okay, have it your way.
Orville makes a decision to send the Wright airplane to the Science Museum in London, essentially as a gesture of protest.
Orville wrote,
I believe my course in sending our Kitty Hawk machine to a foreign museum is the only way of correcting the history of the flying machine, which by false and misleading statements has been perverted by the Smithsonian Institution.
He figured sending this symbol of American ingenuity abroad would get Americans' attention.
And in fact, that was what happened.
The public was outraged. People wrote furious letters to the Smithsonian. The press picked it up.
Major American magazines are doing articles, you know, bring our airplane home.
It was a stroke of political genius, and it struck Walcott right between the eyes. For the first time, he was on the back foot. To save face and try to smooth things over, he assembled a committee of top engineers to review the two aerodromes, 1903 and 1914, and make a ruling on the significance of the changes.
And they came back waffling.
Oh, because they didn't want to displease him?
The honest truth is they didn't want to have anything to do with it. But they didn't say, you're wrong. So Walcott could take the wishy-washy stuff they said and say to the world, well, I mean, here's what these great authorities think. What am I supposed to do? Things go from bad to worse. It is a long story.
That it is. So we're going to speed up just a little bit. In 1927, Walcott dies. A new secretary, Charles Greeley Abbott, takes over. He makes a few feeble attempts to appease Orville, but it doesn't work. Charles Lindbergh gets involved. Even he can't make any headway.
I mean, Orville keeps saying the same thing. All you have to do is give me a piece of paper, publicize it with the original 1903 Langley and the 1914. Show people what changes you made, and that's all you have to do.
But the Smithsonian wouldn't. Another decade passes. Orville writes in his will that the flyer will stay in London when he dies. And by the early 1940s, 2 decades into the feud, both sides had pretty much given up on reconciliation. And that is when an unlikely hero enters the picture, a writer by the name of Fred Kelly. He'd been working on a biography of the Wright brothers. The problem was, Orville Wright wasn't so pleased with how the book was going.
So Kelly's really worried about whether in the end Orville's going to let him publish this book. So he thinks, well, if I can put Orville in my debt.
So he goes to Secretary Abbott and says, come on, man.
He's the one, basically, who just told Abbott, you know, if you just do what he wants, he means it. That's all he wants. And that's actually, I think, what pushes Abbott finally to say, you know, the time has come.
This is where I say, never underestimate the desperation of a writer on a deadline.
Finally, in 1942, the Smithsonian published an article very thoroughly and accurately detailing all of the changes and modifications that had been made to the Langley Aerodrome in 1914 and unequivocally crediting the Wright brothers with having invented the airplane. And that satisfied Orville. That's what he always wanted. He never wanted to besmirch the Smithsonian. All he wanted was an accurate accounting of what was done to the Langley airplane in 1914. And finally, he had gotten that.
Orville Wright was satisfied. But he didn't let the Smithsonian know that.
Being Orville Wright, he twists the knife a little bit. He doesn't say to Charles Abbott, okay, fight's over.
He updates his will without telling Secretary Abbott. So when Orville Wright died in January of 1948, the Smithsonian had no idea what the fate of the flyer would be.
And if you look at the Smithsonian correspondence at the time, they're saying, well, I guess we lost.
But a short time later, the executors of Wright's will notified Secretary Abbott that after its 20-year vacation abroad, the 1903 Wright Flyer would be shipped back to the United States to finally land at the Smithsonian. On December 17th, 1948, the feud officially came to an end. 45 years to the day after the Wright brothers' first flight at Kitty Hawk, the 1903 Wright Flyer took its rightful place at the Smithsonian. 850 people gathered for the grand ceremony.
The British ambassador had come and was at the ceremony, and he said, looking at the flyer, it's a little bit as if we have before us the original wheel. And I think that very, very well sums up the importance of the flyer. It is an object that really represents a fundamental shift in human history.
But like it or not, it's also an object that represents a fundamental truth about human nature and what happens when the darker parts of that nature, ambition and willful blindness, get the better of people, especially people with power.
We're definitely not the hero of the story. We're kind of the villain of this story. What's the value of telling those stories too? You know, the ones where maybe we don't look so great.
Well, it's because we didn't always look so great. No institution is perfect, spotless. We grow and we change and we learn and that's the value, I think.
Today, the Wright Flyer has its own gallery in the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, a symbol of innovation, progress, but also of a wrong righted at last. Beneath the 1903 flyer is the original label presented at its dedication. It states unequivocally,
"The original Wright Brothers airplane, the world's first power-driven, heavier-than-air machine, in which man made free, controlled, and sustained flight. By original scientific research, the Wright brothers discovered the principles of human flight. As inventors, builders, and flyers, they further developed the airplane, taught man to fly, and opened the era of aviation."
You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. The Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum is finally reopened. Go, go, go. It is spectacular. You can see the original Wright Flyer there, as well as Langley's model aerodrome number 5, the one that flew in 1896. And at the National Air and Space Museum's Udvar-Hazy Center, you can see Samuel Langley's infamous great aerodrome, the Mud Duck, that crashed. If you can't get to the museums in person, never fear. In our newsletter, we'll link photos of the new Wright Brothers Gallery, as well as pictures of the spectacular crash of the Mud Duck. We'll also link to some letters from the Smithsonian Archives, from Wilbur Wright to the Smithsonian in 1899. Wilbur Wright introduces himself as a person interested in the study of flight and asks to be directed to any existing publications on the topic.
So I always have said that it's very important for us to answer the mail because you never know which one of those letters is going to change the world.
Special thanks this episode to Peter Jacob and Tom Crouch, both of whom have written extensively on this subject. Tom Crouch's article, "Capable of Flight, the Saga of the 1903 Wright Airplane," was integral to this episode. Thanks also to Allison Mitchell, Katie Moyer, and Amy Stamm at the National Air and Space Museum, and to PJ Tabbitt and Dave Thackera for their voiceover work. Our podcast team is James Morrison, Natalie Boyd, Anne Cananan, Caitlin Schaefer, Tammy O'Neill, Jess Sadek, Lara Koch, and Sharon Bryant. Episode artwork is by Dave Leonard. Fact-checking by Adam Bisno. Extra support comes from PRX. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Our theme song and episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you like our show, tell your friends, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We love hearing from you. If you want to sponsor our show, please visit sponsorship@prx.org. I'm your host, Lizzie Peabody. Thanks for listening.
One of the neat things in my career is to have really been inside that family. I remember I was up in the Library of Congress going through the Wright papers, and for some reason I'd never looked at Orville's notebooks because they're all published and I just used the published. But for some reason I pulled the 1902 notebook out, and it was just one of those spiral things that you stick in your pocket. And I opened the back, cardboard, and there was written in childish script, Ivanette, Ivanette. And I called her and I said, did you know your name is in the inside back cover of your Uncle Orv's 1902 notebook? And she remembered. She said, yeah. She started school in 1902 and they lived just around the corner from the Wrights. And she said, you know, my mom took me over and Orville was there and he said, well, how's school? And I said, well, I can write my name. And he said, well, come show me. And the fact that I could pick up the phone and call the little old lady that little girl had become, you know, made the hair on the back of your neck stand up.
Wow.